From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events from the Central and South America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
Let's start. The big news, apparently, is this coming Sunday, the presidential and the legislative elections in Mexico.
Yeah, and it, all the signs are that Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who most people locally in the region refer to as AMLO, all the signs are that AMLO is going to win. He has something like 52% of voter preferences in the latest polls. And the opposition are so worried about it that they're talking about trying to strike up an alliance between the two main right-wing candidates. But it's very unlikely that, who knows? I mean, given the record of Mexico's electoral system, almost anything is possible, because AMLO, López Obrador, he should have won in 2006.
Right.
And then he should have won in the subsequent election. And but every time it's been stolen from him. But this time, because the situation in Mexico is so dire economically for most people, and there's a lot of resentment against the elites that's kind of curiously associated with the immigration policies of Donald Trump. And even though the Mexican elites have kind of made bleating noises about, you know, how much they object to U.S. immigration policy against people crossing into the United States from Mexico, both Mexicans and migrants from Central America, they are in very much associated with the United States government because of their economic policies over the last 10, 15, 20 years, ever since the introduction of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which for Mexico's agricultural sector was a disaster.
Right. I mean, you have this dynamic going on in the U.S., for example, where the whole conversation about immigration from Central America in particular is completely devoid of the context, the context being the economic devastation of NAFTA to the agricultural sector in Mexico, and B, the role of the United States with the various coups and other ways of maintaining governments that have death squads basically terrorizing the people, driving people out of their homes because they're running because people are shooting at them at their backs. Nobody's discussing that, and the governments, of course, that implement these policies for the United States are not going to be bringing those policies up either.
No, right. So, Andrés Manuel López Obrador has been able to take advantage of that deep resentment among people in Mexico against the political establishment there, represented by the current president, Peña Nieto, and the previous president, people like Felipe Calderón and so forth. And it looks as though he's on a roll. And now, will he win? By all rights, he should. But the Mexican electoral system is notorious for its corruption. Who knows what the... Although at a national level, and its officials may be in good faith, and at a lower level down around the country, and mid and lower level officials in the electoral system are just as subject to intimidation from organized crime, from intimidation by political operators, and corruption as well from both those sources.
Right.
It's impossible to say what the electoral result will finally be, although...
Well, let's talk about intimidation. I mean, the kind of intimidation we're talking about is they murder people. I mean,
over 120 candidates have been murdered in the electoral process in Mexico since that electoral process. A very complicated one, it has to be said, since it began in last September. Yeah. Because it's not just presidential elections. It's legislative, municipal, and a whole series of state elections, a whole series of elections happening all at once. So it's a very complicated electoral process, and that might contribute to confusion. To the extent that López Obrador may well win the election but lose the count. And that's the cliche, isn't it? People win the election but lose the count.
Right, that's right. So that's the they attribute that to Stalin, right? It's whoever counts the votes is the one that matters.
Right. So let's be optimistic. Let's say that Andrés Manuel López Obrador wins the election and succeeds, survives, he's not murdered or assassinated before he actually is inaugurated as president in Mexico. And what are his policies likely to be? And I don't think we should expect any very radical changes in Mexican foreign policy. Mexican domestic policy is likely to be much more subject to reform and change under Andrés Manuel López Obrador than Mexican foreign policy, because Mexican foreign policy already is geared more towards developing relations with China and with the Asian Pacific countries, all the countries of ASEAN, for example, than it is towards consolidating its relationships with the United States. And also Mexico is trying to develop better relations and trade relations with the European Union.
Yes.
So, that kind of foreign policy trend in Mexican foreign policy is likely to be deepened and consolidated under Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Mm. But it's one that was already in train.
Right.
And so the other area of foreign policy where López Obrador is likely to be more belligerent than Peña Nieto is what we were discussing earlier about Mexico's view of U.S. immigration policy. López Obrador is likely to be much more aggressive defending the interests of Mexican people migrating to the United States and the interests of Mexican people already in the United States who, for one reason or another, haven't been able to legalize their status within the United States. So
it's a much better, it's a much, much easier road to hoe, so to speak, if you are, defending your people's rights in the United States or to go to the United States when they're not going there because you're shooting at them. And right. So a change in administration, if we see López Obrador and Morena take power, and I'd like to discuss that too, because we've got the Chamber of Deputies election, the legislative election, and we got to see how they're going to play out. And they are in an alliance, at least for that far, with the Socialist Labor Party, the PT, and also a right wing. Sort of an evangelical party, the PES.
Right. Yeah, I'm not by any means an expert on Mexico's electoral politics, but obviously López Obrador's ability to implement changes in Mexican domestic policy is going to depend on how strong his representation is and his alliances are in Mexico's legislature. And so that's a whole other story, isn't it? But the two areas where López Obrador is likely to try and make most impact is in terms of Mexican agriculture, trying to defend what's left of Mexico's agriculture that historically has always been based on small and medium-sized family farms, right? And so that's one area where he's likely to try and do things to in the interests of people at grassroots in Mexico. And the other, of course, is corruption. And he's likely to to the extent that he can, tackle the chronic corruption in Mexico's public life.
Yeah.
Yeah, what he's going to be able to do in terms of security, trying to roll back the presence of organized crime in Mexico is anybody's guess. I mean, he's likely not to be able to do much at all in that area. But those are areas that he has mentioned as things that he'll work to try and address.
You know, when you have a condition of precariousness or desperation on behalf of the people, then organized crime, flourishes, thrives in that kind of an environment. Then if you can start unpacking that problem, then perhaps, maybe it's a longer trajectory to get to the point of being able to, make irrelevant or certainly tamp down, weigh down the role of these, like, narco-terror gangs, mafia types and such in the public life. But now, people are afraid to even stand up and speak because there'll be a sense. Again, 100 and what? 120 some
over 120.
People. Yeah, candidates murdered.
Yeah, candidates. I mean, you're not talking about ordinary people, activists or campaigners. You're talking about candidates.
I mean, I'm thinking about what it's like to get on the ballot in the United States, for example, where you have people that have to go door to door, knocking on doors, and ask the people who answer to sign a petition to get this candidate or that candidate on the ballot. You know, if there is a mafia that runs everything in the neighborhood and they kill people who oppose them, unless you know which doors to knock on, that's a really formidable task just at the basis of the electoral system.
Oh, yeah, sure. And you can bet your life that local people are well aware of what doors to knock on and which doors to leave alone.
You have to be 100% correct, though.
Yeah.
So,
but that level of chaos, I mean, going back to what you were saying earlier, Don, about what are the reasons, what are the root causes of migration from Mexico and Central America to the United States? And what the United States has done over the years, its very policies, as other writers have pointed out in relation to Europe, its very policies, the foreign policies of the United States government over many decades have created this migration because they deliberately set out to destabilize not just countries, but whole regions.
Right.
And you can see that at work here in Nicaragua now. And I don't know, should we move on to talk bit about Nicaragua?
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about it for a couple of weeks, and now it seems that maybe there might be some air coming out of that little problem. So, let's definitely update what's going on.
Yeah, and what happened in Nicaragua was that legitimate peaceful protests back in mid-April were immediately hijacked, within 24 hours, were hijacked by violent extremists whose agenda was to overthrow the government. Now, and the government response to that has been to avoid broad civil conflict, accept a certain level of violence, withdraw the police from the streets in response to opposition demands mediated by right-wing Catholic Church bishops, so as to, as a kind of guarantee, allow the protesters to develop their agenda, which they did extremely violently. But as time has gone on, the level of popular support for the extremist opposition who are demanding the overthrow of the government has completely fallen away, to the extent where here in Esteli, where I live, and the opposition have made two or three calls for protest marches over the last week, 10 days, and they've had to cancel them because nobody turned up.
Good, yeah.
So the level of popular support for the opposition agenda has completely faded away. And if they could certainly probably organize a big demonstration in Managua, but only by busing in people from the rest of the country.
Yeah.
So what are their demands now? Their demands are no longer let's have the overthrow of the government. Their demands are let's bring forward elections. And one of the reasons that they've kind of moderated their demands or at least the people that are engaged in the public national dialogue, have moderated their demands, is because the in the Organization of American States, Nicaragua's very astute and very experienced diplomats have managed to work with the Organization of American States in such a way as to diffuse the false reports about human rights abuses and so on. And they're working with, they've been working with the Organization of American States since 2016 on an agenda of reforming the electoral system. And that's completely diffused attempts, so far anyway, attempts by the United States government and right-wing politicians like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, for example, to try and get measures approved in the Organization of American States condemning the Nicaraguan government. They've completely failed to do that.
Okay.
So, but what does that mean? That means that because they're working with the Organization of American States and they've agreed an agenda for reform of the electoral system, the likelihood of elections being the currently scheduled for 2021 being brought forward into 2019 next year, that are very slim. I mean, if the elections are brought forward, I think the earliest that they're likely to happen now is 2020. Let's see. But I mean, the key thing is that the extremist Nicaraguan opposition are now very much on the defensive, certainly domestically, because everybody's sick of them.
Yeah.
And they've destroyed the tourist industry with their violent attacks on infrastructure and their roadblocks, their intimidation over the last 2 months. So they've thrown tens of thousands of people into unemployment. You know, and so and there's a strong feeling at grassroots here that people do not want any more economic damage as a result of the opposition strategy of extreme violence, attacking government infrastructure, and apart from that, there's also a deep outrage among a lot of the Nicaraguan population at the importation into Nicaragua of sadistic practices like torture and executions that are characteristic of El Salvador and Honduras and organized crime there and the so-called Maras there. And that has appeared. And you've had health workers, municipal workers being kidnapped and tortured publicly on the barricades. That the, you know, what great public relations, right?
I mean, why did they get rid of Somoza in the first place if they were going to go back to those policies?
Well, yeah, because you have to remember that you're talking about a very extremist minority.
Right.
The mainstream right-wing opposition are increasingly trying to put distance between themselves and the extremists because they realize that they've their activities have been completely counterproductive in terms of rallying support for the opposition demands.
That's an interesting dynamic that you always have to watch, too, when you have these kinds of operations. For example, you had the hard right, the Nazis, literally, in Ukraine, that played the same role in the upheaval there. And the government's response did not lead to there wasn't enough breathing space for people to understand what was happening until they started to see, that kind of behavior. At that point, the government was gone. Here, you have a collective memory of Somoza and also a collective memory of the lost decades of the U.S.-Contra War. You know, you talk about people losing the tourist season. You had a decade or so where, you know, people were not going to Nicaragua for tourist season unless they were, you know, going to be conscripted into somebody's military and shoot at Sandinistas. There's been a very, you know, productive period and a good one for most people in the country since the first election of Daniel Ortega. And I think a lot of people are reluctant to go back to the kind of instability that existed prior to that. And that is something that you didn't have in Ukraine and some other places.
Right. No, I've been very critical of the government for not cracking down right from the start, because whatever they did, they were going to get condemned. It wouldn't have mattered if they'd. And look what happened in Honduras after just a week of protests following the elections there last time.
Right.
They put the army on the street. They declared a curfew. Everybody had to be indoors by 9 o'clock at night. Anybody out on the streets could have been shot.
Right.
Right? That's what happened in Honduras. And where was the outcry then?
Well, it's a longer term game.
Where was the international media then? They couldn't care less.
Agreed with all of that. But in terms of actual policy, long term, that those actions in Honduras are producing what's going to come next, which is at some point people will rise up against what's there. If Nicaragua's government did that, there would also be some long-term, seething anger over it that would be, cooking out in the population, waiting for the next moment like we had in April, that might drive things further. And so acting with moderation with these color revolutions in a can that come out of Washington or whatever isn't necessarily the mistake it appears. It may be a mistake. I mean, you have to look at from situation to situation and a number of conditions that exist at the moment in each of these places. But I understand and acknowledge that there's value in doing what Ortega and the Sandinistas did.
There are strong arguments for what he's done, but one fundamental thing you have to remember is that in Honduras, the repression was against Democrats.
Right.
Here you're dealing with fascists.
Right.
You're dealing with people who kidnap ordinary workers and torture them.
Yeah.
But and so
among
you're dealing with people. You're dealing with people who yesterday. A policewoman was working with municipal workers clearing one of the barricades. The opposition thugs murdered her. They shot her.
Right.
Shot her dead.
I understand that part of it. When you crack down on the fascists, though, you also are cracking down often on people who were fooled by the fascists, who happen to be standing next to them at the moment or whatever. And that's the part knows, but
and that is the argument of the administration here. President Ortega has argued that we have to avoid bloodshed, we have to accept a certain level of casualties and destruction, because otherwise we run the risk of heading into an all out civil war. And
right.
A lot of people think that he's right, but when you look at the deaths and the terrible hardship and suffering that's been imposed by the extreme right-wing opposition here, you have to wonder.
I understand the impulse, too, to want to go, yourself, to, like, want to grab a gun, basically, and go out and get some get-back for it, get some justice.
Right. Well. So then, but that, and putting that back in the context of what we were talking about in relation to Mexico, and all those policies, a guy called Max Blumenthal, who's supposed to be some hotshot reporter on the progressive side of political opinion in the United States, he wrote an article recently explaining how the U.S. government openly boasts about having laid the groundwork for the insurrection here. Now, that's another example of what the United States, what you were talking about earlier, of how United States policy has actually fomented instability and destabilized whole societies. And that is what has led to the whole migration issue in the United States.
Right.
And you can see that from kind of one country to another. If you look at Argentina, for example, Argentina is a member of the G20. It's one of the most advanced economies in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at what's happening in Argentina, that we discussed on various occasions over the last couple of years, and Mauricio Macri, the right-wing president there, came to power on a promise of bringing new prosperity and promoting investment and all the rest of the neoliberal claptrap that these right-wingers always come out with. And anybody who saw that result was immediately able to say, right, well, within 2 years, the Argentinian economy will be in the toilet. And it is.
Here we go. I mean, look, we're going back. It's December 5th, 2001. Okay, they're about 2.5, 3 years into the huge economic collapse that they had in Argentina, with the last group of looters that had control of the government, the Macris of their day. The IMF decides we're not going to release a $1.3 billion tranche of a loan that we've been using to essentially tighten our grip on your country. And that caused an absolute collapse of almost every institution in the society. And after that, you get Nestor, and the economy gets turned around, and then Cristina, and the economy continues to turn around. And then in December of 2015, you get Macri, and here we are, back to the IMF.
Yeah, and the IMF is now the body that decides economic policy in Argentina. And if you're a public worker in the public sector in Argentina, over the last 2 years, your salary has lost 21% of its value. You know, that explains. I think it was yesterday or today. The labor unions in Argentina called a third general strike, and very successful strikes by all accounts. To the point where even Mauricio Macri is calling for national dialogue. You know, Macri is this kind of gung-ho right-winger who imposed his policies against the wishes of most people in Argentina, but he was able to gain the configuration of power in the country's National Assembly, in the lower house and in the Senate, to get his way. And so he imposed those policies, including massive price hikes in fundamental things like the gas price, which is very important in a country like Argentina. I think one of the figures that I saw was that the prices increased by 4,000%.
And you had massive layoffs in the public sector. You had a return to the day of the corporate domination of the media, so that the public discussion of the things that were happening around people changed from one involving the public to one directed at the public. And now he's asking to have a public dialogue where he has the microphone, and the problems that they're going to talk about are things that he helped engineer. It's a pretty interesting dynamic.
Which he can't change anyway, because he's no longer calling the economic shots. It's the IMF
that's
going to decide what happens.
And
all the signs are that Argentina's heading back, as you pointed out, to the worst days of the crisis that it had to confront back in at the very start of the new century.
And we've got like two more minutes, so I'd like to just make a quick reference to Evo Morales's trip to China last week.
Yeah, I know there are a couple of things there, aren't there? I mean, he had a very successful visit to China, and in which President Xi stated that China and Bolivia's relations were now at a new strategic level, and that he was obviously referring to the inauguration over the next year or so of the transcontinental railway that will start from the port of Hilo on Peru's southern Pacific coast, travel through Bolivia, and then across to Brazil's port of Santos on Brazil's southern Atlantic coast. So that is going to be a real game changer in terms of South America's continental economy, and it explains a lot about why even right-wing governments in the region are paying more attention to their relations with China now than they're paying to their traditional relations with the United States.
We're going to have to come back to this next week, Tony. I appreciate your time, as always, and we'll speak with you then.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
The same. Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.